I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we continue our Reflections on Afghanistan series. This time, it's a double header in one show. First up, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski joins us to detail her experiences inside the Pentagon during the Bush years, and how those experiences led her to criticize the political faction known as the neocons, who, during the Bush presidency, were the architects of the foreign policy that got us into Afghanistan and Iraq. In addition, Karen and I will also discuss the latest developments in Afghanistan, including the airport attack by ISIS-K that happened only some hours before we recorded our conversation. A note that Karen and I probably have some ideological disagreements. I'm more of a progressive, someone on the left. She is more of a libertarian. But I think that this conversation is rather important and will give a lot of insight and context concerning the people that led us into wars during the Bush years. Speaking of libertarians, our second guest is none other than former congressman and host of the Liberty Report, Ron Paul. As with Karen Kwiatkowski, I think that Ron Paul and I definitely have some ideological differences. I don't always agree with Ron Paul's takes, but I have always been interested in some of his foreign policy thinking, and especially his opposition to imperial hubris and wars of aggression. You'll hear more about that in our interview with Ron Paul later on the show. But first, we're going to be speaking with, again, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski, who will give us a great deal of insight, I think, on the neocons that got us into the Afghanistan and Iraq conflicts. So, without further ado, let's get right to the conversation with Karen Kwiatkowski. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I've wanted to have on for a very long time, a whistleblower, I would say, of the Bush years. Karen Kwiatkowski, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great.
So, Karen, I wanted to have you on to talk about Afghanistan. But first, for my listeners, I have a lot of younger listeners. I live in a college town that they may have missed the Bush years, believe it or not. So maybe you could talk about your experience as sort of a Pentagon insider.
Okay. Well, I spent 20 years in the Air Force, got commissioned in 1982. So the first 10 years of my service to about 1991 was Cold War. And I know everybody's read about the Cold War. And that term is actually used frequently to mean other things, but the war against communism, the Cold War, not a hot war, against the Soviet Union kind of thing. So this great power competition thing. So that made a lot of sense. It was how I was raised. I was brought up to hate communists, and I worked in the military, and that was our mission, to oppose communism. And then Gorbachev took over, Glasnost, country fell apart, Soviet Union fell apart. It fell apart relatively peacefully. The Eastern European satellite countries, you know, spun off independently. They had a few problems, but they did okay. Same with many of the Soviet provinces or countries that they had included in the Soviet Union. And then it was just Russia. And of course, they had huge economic problems and all the things that happen when you have a massive transition. But what we did in the military was double down. Instead of saying, hey, we won the Cold War, we won the Cold War, we can go do other things, like, I don't know, build a bridge, maybe a highway system, who knows, in our own country. But what we didn't do that. And we had the two military organizations that faced off was Warsaw Pact and NATO. And the Warsaw Pact, of course, fell apart. There was no Warsaw Pact, okay? But NATO, instead of likewise following suit, what they did was they said, oh, well, we should grow a little. We should expand our mission. Hey, maybe we'll even get some of these countries to be on our side against, I don't know, Russia. Well, that's what it was. It was against Russia. But of course, in the early years, Russia was not strong. It had a huge economic. It's actually not super strong now. I mean, it does have a big military. Its economy is better than it was. But so it kind of woke me up we say one thing, but what we actually do is very different. Okay. That shouldn't surprise anybody who's in their 20s or 30s, right? Hypocrisy. We see that. Well, I got to see it straight up in my face in the military. And so I started to study and try to find out why and just read more, you know, study history, see, has this happened before? What is driving it? What's really behind all this? And of course I discovered Lou Rockwell and Ron Paul. And of course I would have discovered Ron Paul anyway, because I'm a huge fan of Ron Paul, but Lou Rockwell has a lot of different writers who, some of them write about domestic and economic issues, and some of them write about state issues and international issues and foreign policy. So I got to see things that I had not seen before that kind of explained what I was seeing at work. And so my last 10 years, I was working in an organization that really was, it seemed to me, confused about what its real mission was, or it was lying about what its real mission was. And I wasn't sure if it was confused or lying, but whatever, that was that. And then of course came the Bush years, or the Bush election of George Bush. And of course, you know, I'm not a Bush fan. I wasn't a Herbert Walker Bush fan. I wasn't a George W. Bush fan, but I also was not an Al Gore fan. And in fact, I think I might've voted Libertarian in that election. I'm not sure. I can't remember, but Bush was harmless until 9/11 happened. Of course, that was 2001. I retired 2003, just a few years later. 9/11 happened. I was in the Pentagon when it happened, not near any parts that were directly impacted at the time. But, you know, we evacuated, and of course, everybody knew somebody, and the whole panic, you know, how is our country attacked? And I have to say, a lot of people, maybe your age and younger, they don't even remember 9/11, which was, for me, as a person in the Pentagon, as a member of the military, Air Force in particular, which runs NORAD, which runs our airspace security in this whole country, you know, I was kind of shocked, like, wait a minute, you know, where's our military doing? We have a massive, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, trillion dollars, military equipment and military organization and administration. And a lot of it's domestic. I mean, it's around the world, but a lot of it's here. And what did they do? A big fat nothing, as far as I could tell. That was a shock. I have to say that was a shock. That's kind of a blow to your gut when you think, and it wasn't so much like, oh, who did this and how good they were, because I didn't think they were that good. I thought we were awful at defending our airspace. It was very strange. In any case, so they immediately start wanting to go to war with Iraq. We had nothing to do with it. They immediately wanted to start going to war with Afghanistan, who I guess the connection was Afghanistan was harboring Osama, whatever. Anyway, by that time I was well informed, and I did my research, and I could see immediately what was happening.
Real quick, I just wanted to add to that. A lot of people forget, you know, when Bush the Younger, as I call him, when he ran, you know, ultimately he ran with a lot of this, like, we're not going to do nation building.
Oh, he did.
Type rhetoric.
Very nice campaign. His campaign was probably, in my lifetime, the best set of campaign lies that we've ever had presented to us. He said, we do not want to build nations. We do not want to intervene. We want to go back to kind of a Thomas Jefferson foreign policy. You know, we'll be friends with everybody, trade with everybody, do not get involved with entanglements. And that was George Washington and Jefferson, these ideas that we hear about every once in a while. It was a good message. It was a very, kind of 1930s Republican message, you know, non-intervention, anti-war. It wasn't fully anti-war, but it was kind of, and so it was close as I've ever seen in my lifetime, anti-war. So yeah, it was a very nice message. And he did nothing for the first 6 or 7 months. And, you know, a president that does nothing and just sits there and eats ice cream, this would be, you know, Joe Biden, I guess. But Joe Biden does stuff. This is the problem. But if they really did nothing, we would all be safer. So George W. Bush the younger, Bush 43, he started off okay. But of course, you forget he had Dick Cheney and a whole crew of neoconservatives advising him. And when 9/11 happened, even before 9/11, these guys were working him hard. And they wanted to intervene. They wanted in particular to do Middle East operations in support of a number of things. One of which, of course, is Israel's security interests, but there were other things too. And they were working him hard. 9/11 happened. It was all over.
I wanted to sort of pinpoint on that term neoconservative for listeners that, again, maybe were just growing up as the war on terror launched. Who are the neoconservatives? What are the neocons?
Yeah. Well, neo, of course, means new conservatives. They're not really new. I've forgotten some of the history of it, but in the 50s, post-World War II, they're very much, they have a worldview. They have a foreign policy view. They have an image of America that is a unipolar dominant imperial power. Now, they don't use the word empire or imperial because that has, you know, connotations of the Cold War, but they see the U.S. as the top dog, and the U.S. has lots of responsibilities. They are statists for sure. So if any libertarians are watching and I say the guy's a statist, they know what that means. They love the power of the state. They want to exercise the power of the state in any way that it can be done. So neoconservatives are very interventionist. They like to use every tool at their disposal. They'll use the State Department. They'll use trade embargoes, threatening and making war, occupying countries, create democracy. In fact, one of the signs of the neoconservatives is they are very pro, well, at least rhetoric-wise, pro-democracy. Like, we should cause the world to have little American republics and democracies or whatever. You know, it's kind of a fluff piece, really, but that's part of their agenda. Now, these neoconservatives are, because they have the word conservative, you'll find them in the Republican Party, but you also find them in the Democratic Party. And they flow freely between the both parties. The origins of them go back to, there was a Washington senator, I can't think of his name now, but back in the 60s, and many of his staffers, Paul Wolfowitz worked for him, a number of the people, and he was a Democrat, a very strong hawkish Democrat. So if you can think of a warmongering Democrat, Joe Biden, for example, might be in his prime. Now, Joe Biden is past his prime, so it's hard to say. If you watch Joe Biden throughout his senatorial his career, he was very much a hawkish Democrat. Many of them are, and those classify as neoconservatives too. So that's my view of them. Now, the Irving Kristol is he may have passed already, but Bill Kristol is his son. Irving Kristol is wrote a article, I think in the late 90s or early 2000s, and he said, "What is a neoconservative?" And he explained what it was, and it's just kind of like what I've said, but you can, if you Google it, you can find out. They very much love the power of the state, both domestically and overseas. They're not afraid of intervention. One of the other problems with neoconservatives, with the exception of guys, warmongers like Tom Cotton, Senator Tom Cotton, who has served, and there's a few others like that who have served, who are also anxious to serve again or make other people serve again, you know, to impose our will around the world. Most of the neoconservatives in the 90s and the 2000s and to the present day have never worn a military uniform. That's not where they come from. That is, they are Ivy League blue-blooded to some extent. Now, one of the things that people hear neoconservatives, it's Jewish people. Well, they're, it's not really Jewish people at all. Religious Jews certainly would not fall into this category because they're not political animals. These are political animals with a fair share of academic Jewish members, but certainly
there's also Irish and Italian Catholic.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Catholics, Protestants, blue-blooded Yankees from Boston. There's a whole bunch of them. Now, the Ivy Leagues, the Ivy League colleges, whoever they educate, which is all those same people, do produce a good fair share of what we would consider neoconservatives. And again, it's kind of a very arrogant, makes sense that Ivy Leagues would produce this. It's a very arrogant worldview that the United States is on top. Now, when I say the United States, they're talking about Washington, D.C. and New York. They're talking about our wheels of financial and political and military power. They aren't talking about the people in the United States. People in the United States, I think most neoconservatives would not approach with the 10-foot pole. They are not interested in the people. They have contempt with the average American. The average American would vote for George Bush because George Bush said, we're bringing the troops home.
I just wanted to add, not to interrupt you, but I just wanted to add to that very briefly. You know, every six or so months, Mr. Robert Kagan himself always writes an article in Foreign Policy, the CFR magazine, yeah, sure. And goes on about, well, we're a superpower now, we're an empire, and these dumb plebs need to get behind the wars we tell them to get behind. You know, and it's people like, I mean, what's weird is we can name the names. It's people like Robert Kagan, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, the Project for a New American Century,
Bill Kristol. Dick Cheney, certainly.
But so in regards to, I think how we describe the neoconservatives, I think you're right. I mean, they people like Kagan, I think, have a real contempt even for the, you know, average American people who don't like these wars. What was your first sort of experience with the neoconservatives? Maybe you could talk about the Office of Special Plans.
Yeah, so this was in my last 18 months in the Pentagon. I worked up at the Office of Secretary of Defense. I worked in, initially when I went up there, I worked in Sub-Saharan Africa policy, which was a backwater. Okay, not a lot of people overly interested in that. But there was expanse happening before 9/11, the growth in the, growth in the, what they, it was Middle East, Iran, Iraq, Near East, South Asia is what they called it. So, and it included North Africa, Morocco and Tunisia and that kind of thing. So that office was growing and people were leaving that office. And I found out after I got there kind of why some people were leaving. Because it was a very politicized office. It was one that, it was the opposite of where I'd come from as a backwater in sub-Saharan Africa. It was very much on the agenda of the bosses at the Pentagon, of Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld. These guys were very interested. This was the focus, because as you remember, after 9/11, they wanted to go to war with, well, the wars were actually planned and ahead of time. Anyway, all this stuff I'm finding out. But as I go over there,
yeah, I think they wrote about this in the Project for a New American Century documents. Yeah,
sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, the plan even before 9/11 was that we would need a galvanizing event like 9/11. This is in 1999. They're writing this.
A new Pearl Harbor.
1998. Yeah. New Pearl Harbor. Something that would get people to shut up and do what they're told, because that's very important to neoconservatives. You need to shut up and do what you're told, Americans. But we needed this event, and once we had it, we would then seize the initiative to form our vision, particularly in the Middle East. It's very focused on the Middle East, and I think this is why, you know, there is oil there, of course, but Israel's also there. And Israel is, it's close to the heart of many neoconservatives, if not all of them, in that Israel is respected by them. And of course, Israel uses those philosophical those think tanks, neoconservative think tanks. Well, Israel funds them. Okay, Israel is interested in using them to some extent to shape the thoughts and the concerns and the budgeting plans and the initiatives of that are paid for by our Congress. So this is a big political operation, and the neoconservative think tanks and the appointees, political appointees in the Pentagon, which in our area where I worked in NISA, Near East South Asia, were entirely hardcore interventionist neoconservative appointees. That this is your category C employee. Every president gets to appoint them. And the ones that came in there were not of a philosophical type that I had ever seen before. And the arrogance, and I have to say, you know, people don't respond well to arrogance, right? They were arrogant. They were here to do something they'd been planning for a long time, and anybody in their way needed to just shut up and you know, do what they're told.
And so, I just wanted to add to that too. I mean, yeah. I think what a lot of people miss, when we're saying interventions, mm-hmm. you know, the neocons, soft power isn't enough for them. It's, you know, we need to start wars.
That's right. Yeah. Because Hillary Clinton was kind of like this. And also back in the day, Madeleine Albright famously said when we were starving the Iraqi children and whatnot, I think she said, what's the point? She said it to Colin Powell. What's the point of having a big military if you're never going to use it? And that is their view of the military. You know, they don't, this idea that the Constitution is established a government to really focus on its the needs of the people, the law, whatever, and the military has a role. Their view is you have this military. This is a tool. It's not something that has a role of defense. This is a tool to change the world with. And since most of them, in fact, almost, I don't know, rarely did any of these neocons, certainly the ones I work with, ever wore a uniform. They never served in the military. They didn't come from military families. Like I said, they're Ivy League. This were very much, the military was separate from what they really believed in, but it was a tool to accomplish their vision and their goals. And so interventions for them were largely military interventions because, you know, I mean, if you're going to put an embargo or economic or talk to them with the State Department, that's really kind of sissy stuff, right? I mean, you can't make somebody do your will by talking to them. You know, you need to bomb them. And there is this contempt for people, contempt for Americans, contempt for people in the military. It extended very much to contempt for specifically Muslims. And this, I think, is in part of the Israeli influence because, you know, there is war in the Middle East. And if it's Jew against Muslim, you know, you always denigrate your enemy. And the kind of contempt for most Muslims, their form of government, their culture, and this isn't one big Muslim culture. Obviously, I mean, you know, Afghanistan as a culture, you've got you know, Arab, you've got all these different things. They're all Muslim, of course. Lots of variation and lots of granularity across those great vast swaths of people, but the neocons have contempt, just a very top level contempt. And that came through. I mean, I'm not making that up. I mean, this came through clearly on a daily basis where I worked. And of course, if you watch the news or read the news or hear them speak, it comes across very, very much. So there's no respect. Anyway, these folks were there. They were making policy, planning wars, doing things and lying about it. And the other thing that really got me, and of course, this is before a lot of people's time, but as we prepared to go to war with Iraq, this is the focus of what I so-called whistleblew about. We were making up stuff and putting it into the New York Times and the Washington Post directly. And these are things that we would see on our documents, stamped top secret and secret. And the next day, no foreign, you know, not for foreign release. And the next day would be front page on a Judith Miller article or one of the guys in the Washington Post. So they used the media to whip hysteria, public hysteria, to go to war with Saddam Hussein. Of course, this is history. And I would think that, well, I know they don't do much in public schools with this kind of thing, but there are plenty of stuff on YouTube that'll give people an idea of how the hysteria against Iraq was whipped up. I mean, there were going to be mushroom clouds over, you know, Missouri and Illinois. I mean, Americans were going to die by the millions. And Saddam Hussein, our puppet for many years, was working with Osama bin Laden, you know, and all that kind of thing.
I mean, I remember some of these people were even pushing a conspiracy theory about the Oklahoma City bombing being done by Saddam Hussein.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And actually, sure, because Islamic terrorism, you got to remember too, going back to 1993 with the World Trade Center bombing there, which did not take the building down, but there was an attempt to, well, there was a bomb that went off in the basement and it did some damage. This was also Muslims, I think the blind cleric or whatever, but Muslim as enemy, Muslim as this bogeyman had been going on for some time. Neoconservatives very much utilized that. And I think they probably believe it. but they also very much utilized it in a very kind of manipulative way, because they don't have respect for the American people either. We can't figure anything out. We have to be told what to think. And this, again, as a free thinking type person, you know, I don't approve of this kind of thing. And I think laws were broken by these folks. But again, laws are laws. The laws are made by the same people. You know, I mean, the what is the Patriot Act? You know, Patriot Act was unconstitutional. So what'd they do? Well, they changed the law, so it would be unconstitutional anymore. And they, you know, backdated it or something. You know, I mean, this is not what normal constitutional republics do. We are past that. We are past that. This country is in kind of a free fall in terms of constitutionality.
So what was your biggest takeaway with regards to your experience in NESA? And also, what's your biggest takeaway about the neocons? And I think that's a good lead into Afghanistan, because the same people who lied us into Iraq gave us Afghanistan.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, there are, I guess I realized that there are agendas which don't maybe match with mine. They don't match with what we are taught, how policy is made. We think this is how it works. This is how a democracy works, but it's not that. We're an oligarchy, and the people in charge of our oligarchy, at least in the 90s and the 2000s, and even to this day, have a philosophy that is not well articulated. It's fear-based. It is expansionist, interventionist, warmongering, and they're running things. Now, when we had Bush, we had 8 years of Bush, and they were well in place. And when Bush was stepped down and gave it to Obama, many of these people work, of course, they do what they always do, revolving door into think tanks and whatever. They never leave DC. They never leave the halls of influence. And they continued a little bit out of the limelight under Obama. But you got to realize the core value system that neocons have in a domestic perspective is very much pro-state. They want a lot of state spending. They don't care if your taxes have to go up, because the state is able to deliver. They think it's able to deliver overseas. They think it's able to really deliver domestically. So they are very smooth, very comfortable in both parties, both establishment parties, the Democrat establishment and the Republican establishment. They can move freely in both those circles. And then, of course, Trump was the Trump card. Trump was the problem, because Trump imagined that he would actually be president. I mean, even after he was elected, he said, "Oh, so I'm president." And he imagined that, because that's not how it works. You are not president. And then Trump actually is, I think, speaks to so many people, or did, because we think a president has power. Trump thought the president had power also.
And he ended up hiring people like John Bolton and Elliot Abrams.
He did. He went through a couple of not too bad national security advisors, but he was worked on heavily. Well, of course, probably one of the most abused and attacked presidents from day one. Even before he was elected, he was very much, you know, hated by the media, hated by the left, hated by the progressives, despised by the neoconservatives. Because what was the big selling point that Trump offered in his campaign? Non-interventionism, bring the troops home. This is what he said. And this is exactly what got George Bush elected. Now, some people would debate that, oh, well, Gore got elected. It really wasn't George Bush. But George Bush was not a popular or a very good candidate. He offered non-interventionism as a key part of his thing. And Americans like that. I don't care if you're, you know, Republican, Democrat, independent, whatever. Non-interventionism is an American value of the people, certainly not the neoconservatives. So they're still here. They stayed here. And how they stayed here is very interesting, because let me tell you, just a half hour ago, I was on an RT thing just for a couple minutes, a few minutes. The guy before me, 5 minutes before me, was Michael Maloof. Michael Maloof worked with them, not personally, but worked alongside NESA, and when I worked there. He's a neoconservative. And so he's a 20-year-old retread, kind of like me, right? I've been out of the Pentagon for 20 years. I'm talking Pentagon stuff. You know, I'm a retread. He's a retread, but he's in studio, RT studio, because guess what? It's in DC. He's in DC. And what did he say? He said, "We'll have to go back to Afghanistan. Taliban aren't going to be able to do it. They're really bad guys. And the ISIS-K are just a tiny bit worse, but ISIS-K are going to topple the Taliban." You know, he's all over this. their theories that the U.S. has to go fix everything. And that's one, part one. And part two is that the U.S. can fix everything. And I think our track record for younger people, you may not see that we should go fix everything, but what you can see with your own eyes is that we are incapable of fixing things overseas, and for very good reason. It's not a slam on the United States. You cannot go in. I mean, heck, imagine Biden, they made a comment about we're going to go door to door with the shot. Well, obviously that was an empty threat. There's no way urban people from the East Coast are going to go door to door in Nebraska and force somebody to take a shot. You don't go into somebody's territory and tell them how it's going to be. And that's what we try to do with our foreign policy all the time. And it is hard. It's a difficult task. We are not equipped for it. We're not the right people to do it. Again, this escapes the neoconservatives. It escapes Michael Maloof, who is still on media talking, spreading the ideas of neoconservatism. They are here. If you can do nothing more than recognize them and think about them, you're in good shape.
So with regards to Afghanistan, were you surprised at how quickly Kabul fell? Because I feel like in some of the interviews you've given before, you sort of echoed sentiments saying, you know, it's going to be chaos as mm-hmm. soon as we withdraw. Yeah. And that's just how it is.
That's right. Well, that's how it is everywhere. It's not a U.S. thing. That's not anybody's thing. If you're occupying, I mean, we've all seen the videos of the helicopters leaving the Saigon embassy. And of course, the modern people say, oh, no, it's not like Saigon. But all withdrawals under pressure, all defeats, they are costly. They are chaotic. People finally, it's like there's a mass awareness all of a sudden that always happens. And they go, oh, my God, this is happening. And it's chaotic. My opinion, just on that subject with Afghanistan, I don't see it as chaotic as it could have been. And I think a big part of this is, well, I don't know the Taliban personally. I'm not, you know, I haven't studied them, but 20 years of war with the United States has made them better, more efficient, and more able to administer both their army and control of territory. So they have some experience in what it is that they're doing. They've come and taken territory and they've lost territory, but they're actually not bad at what they're doing. Plus, I guess you could say they speak the language. It's their country, for God's sake. So, you know, I'm not as alarmed. I mean, I'm saddened by the terrorist attack and the loss of life and the crushing, people are being crushed and all this kind of thing. Bad things are happening. But this will, if you put it in the perspective of 20 years of death and destruction, and I mean environmental destruction, human destruction, cultural destruction, you name it, we destroyed it and made a huge mess. And the country was at war with the Russians and civil war under Taliban rule. Okay, 35 years this country has been under war. I'm actually kind of pleased with how unchaotic the exit has been for those who want to leave. We're also working with the Taliban. We've been talking with them. Trump started talking with them 2.5 years ago. We know them. They know us. We made this agreement. We left out our own appointed government or supported propped up government in Kabul. They were very upset with us. They said, why aren't you talking to us? We should be in on it. And they're like, you know, we kind of knew this is. But here's the problem I have with it. I'm figuring this out. I'm seeing this. So are hundreds of other people. Thousands of people can look and make their own decisions and they can see what's happening. But we would not talk about what we were going to do. We didn't prepare. I mean, I spoke to Sputnik or somebody, and I said, this is months ago. It'll be fast. It'll be very fast because the army we trained will fold. Half of them already with the Taliban. The other half will either get with the Taliban or they will vacate themselves. They will fold. And they did. And they felt that, you know, the whole thing moved very fast. But we couldn't admit that it was a defeat because we couldn't talk about defeat and what that means. It's over. Nobody could say it's over. We couldn't get the word out to people in an honest way. People in Kabul, and this did shock me, seemed surprised. They seemed genuinely surprised when the Taliban marched in and rolled through town, took it over. And I'm like, how could you possibly be surprised? Have you not been tracking their progress for the last 3 months or more? coming in, taking over town by town by town. And I think they were surprised because I think they were listening to the American, either the military spokespeople, the State Department spokespeople, the contractors. Everybody's like, oh, don't worry. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. And you know what it reminded me of course, is it's something I did not live through, but have only read about. But you know how the Jewish people in Germany under Hitler accepted that, oh, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Actually, no, it wasn't going to be okay. Why were they, you know, and part of it's human nature. You know, we don't want to deal with it. I'll tell you this, two or three months ago in May, I guess that was 2 months ago, the contractors were hiring in Kabul. They hired hundreds of people were being hired to go work in Kabul. Now, why in May would they do that when we already knew May 1st was the original Trump exit strategy? Now, he was fought by the Pentagon, by the neocons, by all these people. They did not want to leave by May 1st. And he was very much undercut in what he intended to do. But anyway, it to me, if you're going to be in a foreign country that's been at war that you're occupying, you have a personal responsibility. I don't care if you're a collaborator. I don't care if you're an American contractor, a wife, husband, family member, or an employee. If you're in that country, you have a personal responsibility to make sure you know what's happening all around you. Situational awareness. And I'm not saying it's everybody's fault, but I do think it's gone much smoother than it could have. And if you, and Americans in particular, we do not care much about what happens in other countries, but countries around the world throughout the 1800s, the 1900s, the 2000s, they suffer these crises. Governments, Venezuela, right, very not too far from us. And we have no sense of the chaos that ensues when governments change. We act like it's going to be all smooth. We have no sense of it. And yet this is not bad compared to what we've seen even in the last decade around the world. So anyway, I'm not defending anybody. I have huge issues with how the military did this. And I certainly have issues with what our government has done. But it's actually gone miraculously well so far. And fingers crossed, no airplanes have been shot down out of that airport yet. So fingers crossed.
I wanted to ask, you know, what do you make of this whole, I mean, there's a blame game right now. And I think we can criticize Biden for the exit strategy. To be honest, I was happy he pulled off.
Yeah, me too.
The withdrawal.
First thing he's done that I liked.
But with regards to the blame game, I feel like, you know, why do we have George W. Bush going on TV talking about how bad the withdrawal, this is the guy that got us there.
Well, the neocons, well, you have to, okay. First off, there are politicians and they all want their legacy to be, you know, nice and nobody wants to be criticized. They're psychopaths, but they're very sensitive. Well, actually, I think that is part of the psychopathy. You know, you're a little bit sensitive to criticism. How dare you? So they are a good many politicians are psychopathic. This is the problem. So they're very narcissistic. They don't want to be criticized. That's part of it. The other part of it is, though, is not the end game, but the next game. And the next game is like Mike Maloof was talking about tonight. And what the neocon playbook is calling for. And that is, we're leaving Afghanistan, but not really, because we're going to have over the horizon attacks and shows of power. And we're going to hunt you down. You heard what Biden said tonight. We're going to hunt him down. It sounded very much like what Bush said, what Obama said, what Trump said, and now what Biden said. It's a cliche at this point, but we're going to hunt you down at a time of our choosing and put the hurt on you. So the idea that we are still going to intervene in the Middle East and we're still going to push for our various political interests. This will be salvaged by the neocons. This is what they want the next narrative to be, that yes, we've left Afghanistan and yeah, we're talking to the Taliban. We'll probably recognize their government, but you know, there's bad ISIS-K and it's ISIS-K. It's just like the virus. It has to have a variant. You know, ISIS-K. Who ever heard of that?
I was going to say, I even hear some Republicans saying that ISIS-K is working with the Taliban, when my understanding is that they're, you know, very much in competition with each other.
Yeah, I think they are. Although I think there's some Arab influence as opposed to Pashtun, but or Pashtun, I guess. But so there's some, I think, ethnic differences within the Muslim umbrella, you know, and within really the Sunni umbrella, because if they're from Qatar or or Saudi, you know, they are Sunni, just like the Taliban, they're Sunni, but it's like the, it's like Protestant religions, you know, there's a very much, there's all different kinds of them. They're all Protestant, but they all have their variations and their different approaches. My opinion is, and this is my concern, and this is kind of off the, maybe off the wall a little bit, but throughout the time that ISIS has emerged in Iraq and in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, it has always been connected with American interests in some way, either fomenting something that caused us to have to stay when we were going to leave, caused us to have to move in a new territory that we actually wanted to move into, things like that. So when I hear ISIS-K, I really want to go review whatever I can find about the CIA, and certainly what I can review from the Pakistani intel organization, which historically has close ties with their CIA, but they have their own issues with us too. So I think it's kind of a, I don't see them as any near peer competitor to Taliban. I don't see them as widely popular. The fact that they are attacking, you know, Afghans at the airport, killing women and children, this is very, this is a throwaway violence. It's not going to get you. You might, you know, maybe you're going to go to heaven because you're a martyr, but if you kill an American, but overall it's not high value. It's kind of more of a act of frustration. So I don't see them as a big threat. However, imagine if they were a big threat. Imagine if now we're friends with the Taliban and the Taliban is facing ISIS-K insurgencies throughout their country. Well, maybe since we're friends with the Taliban, maybe they'll invite us back in to do something, right? Or they'll let us bomb their country or certain parts of their country. This is what the neocons want. They do not want to leave. They didn't want to leave under Trump. I mean, Trump was had pushback from think tanks, conservatives, even Congress. In fact, both sides of Democrats and Republicans said, oh, no, we can't do it, Trump. We can't do it. Military said, oh, no, we can't do it. Military even lied to him. They lied to him about what they would tell him one thing and tell their troops, oh, don't worry. He's not pulling out. You just keep staying there, which is what I think they told the people in Kabul. Don't worry. We're not really leaving.
I have to be honest. I even wondered if there was early on in this. I was wondering if, you know, maybe military officials or even intelligence lied to Biden.
Oh, yeah. Well, with Biden, it would be very reasonable to do so because I don't think Biden's all there. So they could say anything to Biden and they could shape him. With Trump, Trump imagined himself, and he's very much a hands-on guy, so he wanted to know what's happening. He has a great mental capacity to take in a lot of information, you know, and he wanted to know a lot of information, and he had a pretty good memory. So I think what they couldn't lie to him directly, but they could undercut his orders or his decisions, which is what they did. With Biden, I think they can put words in his mouth pretty easily.
When you mentioned the CIA and ISIS, were you talking about maybe like things like, I think there was an Operation Timber Sycamore and the funding of moderate rebels and whatnot.
Well, not that particularly. I don't know the details on that per se, that particular thing. But in general, what our CIA has done and some of our military too, this is how we get our own people in, right? You help one small side. In fact, there's a terrorist group that the neocons are very favorable towards in Iraq, which is a anti-Iran terrorist group harbored in Iraq or had been, the MEK. And MEK has been on the State Department terrorist list, and many of the neocons in our government and in think tanks have pushed consistently to get them taken off of the terrorist list because they like the MEK, because the MEK is against the Ayatollah rule in Iran, and it's kind of a thorn in their side. So ISIS has served that purpose. You know, you pick a group that can kind of be a second party doing things that help you out. I'm not saying they have anything to do with ISIS-K, but the people in the region think this, they believe this. If they don't like ISIS, they say, well, the Americans either fomented them or funded them or both. Some of ISIS is genuine. Some of the rebellion and the resistance is genuinely caused by our own actions. If you kill my family at a wedding, which we've done numerous times in pretty much every country over there, well, that creates people that want revenge, right? I mean, we would be the same way if that happened.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, a lot of people are talking about, oh, we have interpreters that are stuck in Afghanistan now. And I feel bad for them. But at the same time, you know, if you're a young Taliban rank and file soldier, you're thinking to yourself, oh, you were collaborating with these people that bombed a wedding where my brother or sister died.
And there may be, and also, I don't know this well myself. I'm not an anthropologist or a cultural expert, but there is in Afghanistan in particular, as in many other places, eye for an eye attitude, an eye for an eye. And in fact, this is something you hear in this country, but we don't really live that way. But this eye for an eye thing, revenge, retribution, this is real. So there will be this kind of thing as the Taliban shakes out its control and stabilizes whatever it can stabilize in Afghanistan. There will be these actions, and some of them will be conducted at the very lowest level by a group of cousins, or this clan or this family is going to hunt down and find the one person that they blame or can get a hold of that is responsible for this thing. So, but the U.S. violence and the, you know, the different things that we did, which were so frustrating, drone strikes, you know, who do you blame for a drone strike? Some kid in Nevada, you know, I mean, it's very difficult to deal with this, and they've had to deal with it. And that has caused some of the violent groups and terrorist groups, if you want to call them terrorist groups, they consider us a terrorist group. Most people that live in the Middle East, particularly in this day and age, after we've been there, you know, between 1991 in Iraq and on, and then Afghanistan, they consider us to be terrorists. You know, we're the ones blowing up stuff.
I was going to say, in a way, you know, Scott Horton talks about this a lot.
Yeah.
He's a great researcher, great radio host, but you know, in a way, we played right into bin Laden's hands. I mean, he wanted us to get involved in these forever wars. It was a sort of drain the empire of its resources type strategy. But not only that, I mean, when you go and you bomb these countries and these populations, where are they going to turn to? They're probably going to turn to the extremists.
That's right. That's right. Because when you get really mad and you feel like your hands are tied and you have no power, well, wait a minute. Didn't we have cities burning last year? Why were the cities burning? Well, you could blame George Soros for some of it, but really, people do get angry when they feel things are unjust, things are taken from them, and they have no power. That's when you go into the street. The French people who have been told they have to do this and that, and they're finally fed up with it, they feel powerless. So what do? They go to the street. They seek sometimes violence. So it makes sense. But yeah, I'll tell you, this is the other concerning thing, and I'm sure we're going to hear more about it in coming days, weeks, and months. But, you know, our instructions to all of the people that wanted to leave Kabul were to flock to the airport, and we'll process you through those many gates to get you inside. And yet that was exactly the situation where the suicide attacks could be most destructive. And, you know, we're talking about our 13 men. I guess there's 13 people of our guys that died today or last night. We didn't talk about the numbers of the Afghans that died. There were a lot of them. You know, so this is very destructive and awful, and they wouldn't have been there in part because of how we actually advised them. Then once that happened, we said, or once we realized it could happen, because I think they had intelligence saying this was going to happen. Then they said, oh, no, people, don't come to the airport. Please vacate from around the airport and stay home, and we'll get you out over a period of time. Those that are left.
Do you think there's a case that can be made that, you know, we really should have never occupied Afghanistan to begin with? Maybe we should have tried to get bin Laden, but, you know, was this occupation really necessary?
Well, of course we should never occupy. We should never occupy anything. I mean, we don't do a good job occupying places like in down in Louisiana, New Orleans, when they had the flood Katrina. You know, your military doesn't do a good long-term job of occupying any civilian population. Certainly we should not have done that. And I think those good arguments, and you mentioned Scott, you know, Scott Horton has a huge book that he wrote not too long ago on Afghanistan. And he makes the case, of course, there's no reason to occupy it. We wanted bases there, and we wanted control, and we wanted to be able to threaten and interfere with Iran. This is all always about a larger issue than just Afghanistan. We certainly wanted to have a southeastern position with which to keep an eye on Russia or harass Russia. So, you know, these are great game type of things that they don't talk about to the American people. The American people is like, well, these are bad Muslims. We want the girls to learn how to read and write. And, you know, it's funny because 20 years after this, I think the highest number we got of girls going to school was something like 33%. After 20 years, it was still only 33%. So this is not, well, that's a made up objective anyway. That was what they talk about when they want to say, oh, why are we there? So girls can read. No, not really. I mean, they can't read in America. So what's, you know, I don't know why we go to Afghanistan.
I was going to say, what's the sort of cui bono, the who benefits? Is it all about, you know, money, weapons contractors, or is it sort of just the ideology of the neocons, this sort of revolutionary ideology that they have?
Well, who benefits? It is contractors and money, and it's the also the machine benefits, because if you're, you know, the Pentagon, what's the Pentagon's focus right now and has been shifting for several years now? China, right? We're going to make
the Asia pivot.
Yeah, the Asia pivot. So we can afford to leave Afghanistan and leave a bunch of equipment there. They didn't even bother to get rid of it because that could be useful for us. Because if the Taliban uses our equipment or sells it, then we can embargo them. Then we can interfere with them. Maybe we can go back and mess with them, you know. But it's about money. You have to follow the money. It's always about the money. There were some, back in 2001, there were some, UNICAL had a pipeline that we were working with the Taliban in charge in 2001. Then we were working with them to try to get this pipeline finished. So back in that day, 20 years ago, gas pipelines, oil transit type things, bases, we wanted bases, but there's no better way to get bases than just bomb some stuff and take over their property and build a base there, which is what we did all over the Middle East, but certainly in Afghanistan and in Iraq. So why do we need bases? Well, that's for the next big thing, right? Iran. So it's money, it's a little bit ideology. It's also, to me, I mean, I have contempt for neoconservatives who don't have lives beyond, you know, exercising. It's like they're playing with little toy soldiers. They're like little boys, and there's not that many women. There are a few, but it's mostly male. It's mostly a male phenomenon. I mean, when you look at who's speaking, you know, but they're little boys with their toys who never really grew up.
They always want, you know, my friends in places like Greenville, PA, to fight the wars, but they'll never send their kids off. Robert Kagan's
Their kids do not. No, not at all. So it's kind of their game. It's like their game. And so it's kind of like, an elite group that gets to play while all the rest of us work and die. That's how
they're playing with human lives.
Yeah. But it's fun because they don't know them and they have contempt for them. And, but you'd be amazed. Well, you maybe wouldn't be, because you're pretty well, you're well read. You know all these guys. You know, Scott's got this down. But so many people have seen it. Ron Paul, his whole career. You know, these people, they don't care. They care about themselves. They care about a vision that they think is going to be good. And they're not even interested in debating that vision. They simply say, how do I get it? Well, I get political power, and then I exercise the power of the state that I control.
There's just two more things I wanted to ask, I'll let you go because I know we're running up against the hour.
Yeah.
Why Iran? Why are they so interested in Iran for my listeners?
Well, it used to be oil, you know, back when the Roosevelt kid was working for CIA and fomented the first revolution. We overthrew the elected leader of Iran and who was the bad guy we put in there? I can't even remember.
We overthrew anyway,
57. They had an elected. Yeah, 53. We overthrew that elected leader. He was socialist of some sort.
Mossadegh,
yeah. And Mossadegh wanted to, he was going to basically nationalize the European and American oil industry there. And back in the 50s, you know, we didn't want that. We figured it was our oil to take out, as we do pretty much everywhere we go. So he had to be replaced with a puppet. So we put the, he wasn't a prince, what, king or something. Anyway, we put the other guy in. And then, of course, under Jimmy Carter's era in the 70s, that they did a revolution against that. But that lasted from 57 until 79. And then, and actually, if you think about it, then, you know, we have the war against in Afghanistan in 79 and 80 with the Russians. We're not involved except by helping. I don't know. Who are we helping? Osama bin Laden, right, against the Russians. You know, there's these threads that connect us. But I think it started with our issues with Iran are twofold. One of them, of course, is the Jewish state. Israel is very concerned about Iran. They can see, they see Iran as their arch enemy, the most capable of all of their enemies, the one that they cannot really defeat or overcome or bring to the table. And it's funny because the largest expat Jewish community in the Middle East, it's not in Israel, was in Iran for up until very recently. And it's still, they have a, I think a lot of them have left over time because of all the hostilities, but it was a home. Iran is a very diverse place with a really an interesting kind of tolerance. We don't see that. That's not what is presented to us. But Iran is a big focus for the greater Israel plan, which neocons in many cases, most cases, they agree with that. And then of course the oil. And then also Iran is not Arab, it's Persian. And it isn't a nice location to go on to India and China. So there's some strategic stuff. It has wealth. Really, it's beyond me why we would be so obsessed with it. I personally am not as obsessed with Iran. I'm not. To me, it's a nice country. Leave it alone. I don't care. You know, like all the rest of them.
So the last question I wanted to ask you, and, you know, I think we probably come from different ideological backgrounds. I come from the more progressive sort of lefty end of things. And I have a lot of listeners like that. And I think we should listen to each other, though. And I think we can learn a lot from libertarians. So what would you say to my progressive listeners in regards to why we should think about, you know, the neocons and their type of foreign policy?
Okay, well, they are pro-war. And to me, one of the biggest things of that is pro-destruction of the environment, pro-destruction of poor people, because usually we go to war against poor people. It is statist and centralizing, which leads to totalitarianism, which I don't think any good progressive agrees with. You know, we hear in the left and right in this country, you'll hear the right will say, oh, the left is totalitarian. They want to make it, but the real progressives are not. I mean, your progressive listeners in their 20s and 30s are not trying to, I think, take over the world or control everybody. It's really, to me, and I could be wrong, but I think of it as a live and let live progressivism. So if people feel that way, and of course the environment, you could talk about climate change, but I'll just talk about not the future because we don't know the future, but we know right now we have an earth, we have an environment. The biggest destroyer of that environment is the United States military, for God's sakes. And then you say, well, what's on that environment? Well, human beings live there. We were the biggest destroyer of them. How about animal life, plant life? Yeah, all that, it's gone. You want to talk about who emits carbons? Fifth largest consumer of oil in the planet is the United States military. What is that? So the neocons love all that stuff. So if you're a progressive or a lefty or whatever, however you find yourself on a spectrum, be aware of what neoconservative, you know, what neoconservatism is and what it stands for, because I'll tell you, the neoconservatives will say, oh, we love the planet. Yeah, global warming is a big problem. We've got to have carbon credits. We've got to go forward and make this world different, or we're going to lose the planet because it's going to warm up and between ice caps melting and earthquake, you know, you name it. They are on board with that. And a good progressive or an honest person really needs to look beyond that, because for neoconservatives, they wish to harness the power of your state, okay? The state, whatever we live under, this government corporate oligarchy cronyist thing that we live under in this country, neocons don't have a problem with it. They just want to own it, and they want to have it go out and do what they think is right. And they're not going to consult with the lefty progressives, and they're not going to consult with the libertarians, and they're not going to consult with anybody that lives in this country. They have a vision. They want to do it. They are people that you should be aware of, because many of them, especially after Obama and during Obama, we saw this, you know, they backed off of some of their warlike rhetoric under Obama, but their agenda still continued on. And with Trump, they thought Trump would be easy push. You know, we can do this. And Trump turned out to be kind of a pacifist. He wanted to bring the troops home. They disagreed with that and undercut him. And I'll tell you just an ideal example of a neocon. Just take a look John Bolton. Look at John Bolton, not physically. I mean, you could look at him physically, but I mean, look at what he says and writes and what he thinks. And that should scare everyone, progressive left, hard right, libertarian right, anarchist, center of the road guy, all of us should be frightened by that kind of thing. It is destructive to people, the environment, to our way of life, to a constitutional republic, to a democracy, all of that. They don't care about any of that. They care about power. And they do have a very powerful mouthpiece. I mean, if you listen to mainstream media, you will hear neoconservative ideas preached at you on a daily basis. And we need to sort through those, be aware of them. They're not healthy. It's not healthy at all.
And the only thing I would add to that is, you know, just the cost of human lives. I think whether you're left or right, you know, we should oppose imperial hubris.
That's right. Absolutely. And all good and true and right people in all generations oppose that kind of hubris. They oppose concentration of power. You know, we've all heard the Lord Acton phrase, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. We know this. You know, we recognize it, and it's what you have to fight. Neocons are part of the problem, and they are relevant because they tell good stories. They tell good stories. I've heard their stories all my life, and sometimes they sound good. It's like, oh yeah, we should do this, but we should not do this.
Well, Karen Kwiatkowski, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work?
Everything, if I write something, it's always on Lou Rockwell, and I have an archive there of all the things I've written in the past 20 years or so. It should all be linked. And I don't really do much. I don't have a blog or a Substack. I've been thinking about it, but you know, it's all I can do to just get through the day. So, but Lou Rockwell has all my stuff, or you can Google me, I guess. Who knows what's out there.
Well, thank you again for joining us on Parallax Views.
Okay, thanks so much for having me.
Well, Parallax Views listeners, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski, a Pentagon insider at the time of the Bush administration years. I think her insights are invaluable. And now we move to the second portion of today's show with Ron Paul, the former congressman and host of the Liberty Report. In this conversation, you're going to hear us discuss a number of issues, including why Dr. Paul signed the authorization for use of military force in 2001 after the September 11th terrorist attacks. Will also talk about his run-in with Rudy Giuliani at the 2008 presidential debates. For folks that may not remember, Ron Paul spoke about the issue of blowback and its role in creating terrorism. Rudy Giuliani then went on a tirade yelling at Dr. Paul and claiming that he was blaming the American people for 9/11 or some such. Really, really wild stuff. We'll talk about that and a number of other issues, including the relationship between the war on terror and the assault on civil liberties. And, of course, the prediction Dr. Paul made back in 2011, saying that if we didn't pull out of Afghanistan then, we'd be stuck there for another 10 years. And of course, that's exactly how things unfolded. All that and more in our conversation with Dr. Ron Paul, former congressman and host of the Liberty Report. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation. Welcome to Parallax Views, former congressman, host of the Liberty Report, and a very staunch critic of U.S. empire and wars and just interventionism with regards to our foreign policy. Ron Paul, how are you doing today?
Doing well. It's nice to be with you.
So, Dr. Paul, I wanted to have you on the show because of the recent developments with Afghanistan, you sort of have an inside perspective, having been in Congress when we invaded Afghanistan. Could you reflect on that? And also, are you conflicted at all looking back on the AUMF, or the authorization of use of military force, from 2001?
Yes, it's an interesting story and an important story, because I did support the use of military force. But the legislation said that we should give the president the authority under the circumstances. It was just days after, 9/11, to retaliate anybody that was involved in 9/11. And so that was the force, but they've been using it, that authority, for almost every invasion out. And the whole thing is, the Afghan government, the Afghan country, had nothing to do with 9/11. Matter of fact, the Taliban had nothing to do with 9/11. It was Al-Qaeda and later on ISIS that was involved. So it was the abuse of the power, which means the lesson that should be learned. I know the lesson. It's just that sometimes it's difficult. The lesson is, you can't ever trust the government to live within their reins, because you could argue, well, if they lived within their responsibility, they wouldn't even come to get authority without asking to declare war, make a declaration of war. But boy, it was just their opportunity, because most of the attention was directed toward Iraq and other places, and ISIS and the Al-Qaeda. But the emergency was, and there were statements like, I don't know which one it was, Cheney or somebody says, now we have the opportunity, to go into Afghanistan. So the plan there was to go in. But that was similar to the plan to pass the Patriot Act, because the Patriot Act passed even faster than this authority. And the Patriot Act was much easier to deal with, because it was a domestic invasion of all our privacy. It was horrible, horrible. And so there weren't very many people of us that, opposed it. But at home, they took care of it. But the Patriot Act had been written. They didn't write it after 9/11. They went in and pulled the drawer out. Here it is. And put it up there, and it was passed, in no time. So it's the making use of emergencies to promote the empire. And to do that, you have to undermine the liberties and the protections and the wealth of the nation. And they've been doing that. But that 20 years in there, Walter Jones was a real strong supporter of the military before we went in there. He was converted, became the strongest anti-war a member of Congress, and he and I worked closely together. Tragically, he died not too many years ago, but he was absolutely right and fought it all the way along. But no, it was misguided. It was based on interventionism, had nothing to do. One thing that really annoys me the most when we deal with this thing is they justify this to the American people and to the military. Oh, you're a good patriotic person. You're going over there to protect the Constitution and protect the people's liberty. That's just not true.
I just wanted to add to that, too. With that AUMF, ultimately, they didn't really declare a war in Afghanistan. It was just sort of a very vague authorization of the use of military force.
Right. And you could do a lot of things, because I understand that the planners of 9/11, I think they did some planning in Spain. I think they did some in Florida and some other places that were very friendly. Like in Florida, they learned how to fly airplanes, but not land them, And those plans were there. So you could argue, well, it looks like we better bomb Florida. That was the equivalent. But it was a tragic era. But I did get into a bit of a conflict, a little argument with Giuliani during the presidential fights, because I said, that people do things for a reason. One of the reasons was that they were over here doing damage to us, mainly because we had been over there and we'd just gone 10 years of bombing Iraq. And that is a challenge, because all of a sudden, you mean we have responsibility? What kind of a American hater are you to actually look within? But I happen to have this weird belief about patriotism. It should endorse and protect your right to criticize your own government. That's what I think being a patriot means.
I just wanted to add to that, that Giuliani moment. I remember that very clearly. I was so mad when Giuliani was saying that he was claiming that you were blaming the American people for 9/11. That's not what you were saying at all. You were talking about blowback, which the CIA teaches about.
Right. They're the ones that introduced this whole notion and warned us. You know, they say, you know, when you do things over there, it'll come back to haunt you. And that's exactly what happened. But over the years, even before I was in Congress, I was very leery of the CIA. But as years went on, more and more, the CIA, the proper position to hold on the CIA is it should be abolished. I mean, it is secret government at its worst. I believe it's involved in the most vicious of the assassinations that occur domestic and international.
With regards to the Afghanistan war, where do you think America ended up falling down when it came to this war? Is it just a matter of, to me, it seems like when we occupy a country, the people that are being occupied, the Afghans themselves, they have a lot to lose. It seems like it was an existential thing for them, whereas it may have not been for America. So they were maybe fighting for everything they had.
I guess because there's always somebody in that country that are a little, you know, even if you go into a country that's a dictatorship, there's always people there that would take a different position. Say in Vietnam, they weren't all communists, so they were able to, galvanize the people who didn't like communism, but it still didn't justify us going into nation building. And that's what we've been doing. And then eventually, I know a lot of people think we're going to get our freedoms back. America has a good reputation, powerful economics. They have a lot of prosperities. They helped a lot of people survive World War II. And you can't argue with that because there were some vicious dictators that declared war against us. So that's what the people remember. So they say the Americans are coming to help us. But now look at what's happening. Look, this is what's happened to our financial system. Look at what's happening in Afghanistan. Now it's being challenged. So in a way, it's a type of an awakening that may be positive. They're saying, well, maybe Ron Paul's right and his friends might be right about not having an aggressive foreign policy of empire. And same way at home, maybe they'll wake up and say, well, maybe deficits aren't that good. Today, though, most people don't care about the deficit as long as you're going to get a check. And the people who get the biggest checks are the corporations and the banks. I mean, and in the military industrial complex. But you also have to send the checks out to the little people. And they've been kept going. So they don't even want to go back to work. It looks like the checks are going to continue forever. But that cannot last. It's going to end. And it's going to end probably domestically like our occupation of Afghanistan has ended.
So I have to be honest, it's interesting because I come from a more left-leaning background, a big fan of Bernie Sanders and whatnot, but I also have a lot of respect for your criticisms of foreign policy. And I think there's both people on the left and the right that are critical of US foreign policy. I think most American people were for a withdrawal before the fall of Kabul, and we still have a large contingent of Americans that are for the withdrawal. So what do you make of all this support for the withdrawal from both ends of the political spectrum?
Well, I think that's good. And I think there was some coalition building over the war issue. You take, I worked with even Bernie. He was on the Foreign Affairs Committee with me, and we would do things together. But in a limited fashion, there were things that we disagreed with. But on the foreign policy, you know, there was agreement. Dennis Kucinich turned out to be my closest ally. He wasn't, you know, real overly progressive. I would consider him a moderate Democrat, but he and I became good friends. And we worked on the war issues, stopping war, anti-war, and that can happen. I'm baffled about why the Democrats treated Tulsi the way they did. Well, you could say, why did they treat me? Because some Republicans believed what I was believing, and they used to really be, strong endorsers of that position. But Tulsi gets shunned, and they never wake up and say, why should we have a policy that ends up with a crash of that policy in Kabul? Why shouldn't we have Tulsi talking like a good progressive Democrat? So I think, the one person that sort of impressed me is Bill Maher. At one time he called me the worst thing in the world, and then he read what I was doing and he said, he's my favorite congressman now. So, but he's sort of changing his tune. He's willing to criticize some of this stuff that is overboard, but so I don't know why I should even be attempt to advise the Democrats, because they're probably a little more resistance to this than the neocons. But the neocons, because I see the problems as a libertarian. Well, the enemies in the Republican and the Democratic Party. I used to kid a lot. I say, Washington is not so bad. There are only two groups there that you have to deal with. You take care of them, and we'll be all right. It's those conservatives and liberals. Those are the people we have to deal with. And yet, there are some conservatives, if they are constitutionalists and civil libertarians, they should be able to work with Democrats. See, I argue the case that I found on the university campuses that I could argue the case that you want to bring people together, tell them what real liberty is all about. And one of the things I enjoyed most was my visit to Berkeley. I had the biggest crowd of the whole campaign, and there were young people. I could talk about ownership of property, and I didn't get booed. And yet they liked their life. Run your own life. If you mess it up, you be responsible. And they didn't boo me for that. They clapped for that, because I said, you might mess up, but you can't, if you screw up your life, if you have your liberties and you screw it up and do dumb things, you have to take care of it. You can't come crawling for the government to go and bail you out and go to somebody and steal from somebody else to bail you out of your problems.
I just had two more brief questions. The first one is, when it comes to empire and war and why we oppose these things, I think something that you've drawn attention to is the way in which these wars and this empire building is actually used against us. It's used to take away our civil liberties, and you've been critical of things like continuity of government planning. And I wanted you to talk about the connection there. What's the connection between war and the assault on civil liberties?
Well, every war has undermined civil liberties all the way back to certainly in the Civil War, World War One, World War II, and it was bipartisan, and they play on the thing of patriotism. That was why I was a bad guy, because I was unpatriotic. I liked the enemy. I liked the people who bombed us and Bin Laden. I was not wanting to, that sort of thing. They play on the patriotism. But what they don't want to really pay attention to is what's going on. Why do we lose our liberties? Because they have an empire. You can't maintain an empire without authoritarianism. And so the authoritarians say more and more, people, and then they get into the business of really lying. I think good politicians, they sort of, they're white lies, and they're demagogues, but it's all based on lying. But why would the people go along with it? Well, the people who are willing to lie and deceive and steal and pick special interests, they're willing to do this. I think a true libertarian or a principled civil libertarian or a good progressive should not be that anxious to get political power. It's the temptation to have political power that happened. And right now, the way I see things coming together, the political economic power is drifting into a corporatist state. Corporatism, it was crony capitalism, corporatist state. And that Mises, the great Austrian economist, said that's what America is up to. They've already started, and he died in 1971 about it. He says we're moving in that direction, the corporate state, and it will lead to fascism. So I really believe that, because look at what's going on in this country, and it's endorsed by, you know, the very conservative Republicans and conservatives as well as the Democrats.
Last question I wanted to ask you. In 2011, you gave a famous speech saying that, you know, if we didn't pull out of Afghanistan then, you know, we'd be there for another 10 years and it would all end in chaos. How were you so prescient? How did you know?
You know what? I thought about that and I said, no way. I didn't sit down and, oh, let me see what's going to happen in 10 years. By 10 years, this is going to happen. It was one of those things that was sort of buried somewhere in my brain. It was sort of a spontaneous thing. I was in the middle of a speech and I wasn't reading it. And I said, if you guys keep doing this, we'll be there for another 10 years. And it was just a sentiment. It was buried in my brain, but it wasn't a calculation. I wasn't going to be betting any money on it. You know, it's just that I looked at policy and they hadn't changed it. It was there 10 years and I knew what I was up against. You know, people like Bernie Sanders and Dennis Kucinich would endorse these things to try to get us out of there. It was just a sentiment I felt. The number just came out of the air. So I find it sort of ironic that all of a sudden, boy, he really knows how to make prediction. But I wouldn't want you to take all my predictions about what I think the price of the stock market will be next Monday.
And just real briefly, because it's been on my mind, what do you make of this blame game? I know you had an article about, you know, don't just blame Biden for this, if you could talk about that.
Well, yes, because I think the mistakes have been bipartisan, so it should be a bipartisan blame. It was sort of the thing about why we got bombed. It was bipartisan. Yet I have to be careful there, because I can't paint Biden as a saint. I mean, he's screwing up too, just like the Republicans are screwing up. So he didn't cause the inflation. You know, the inflation has been created, you know, it's been going on, especially since 2008 when we had the downturn and we went into QE. Inflation is the artificial increase in money and credit. That is printing Federal Reserve notes and creating money. Increase in the money supply devalues the currencies and prices go up. It distorts the economy. You have all this malinvestment and it subsidizes the welfare warfare state. It subsidizes the politicians who are in charge. So, I don't want them to narrow it down, you know, to Biden. But I would say the same thing sometimes with Trump when they would say Trump. But he was all over the place on some of the things like foreign policy. But he would say things and take credit for it. I want it to be factual. I want it to be based on, a real understanding. Besides, it's a good way to get other people to think, well, you know, Ron Paul's, yeah, I think he's trying to tell us the truth. And that was always the best compliment I could get when I was on the campaign trail, because I'd ask him, I said, you know, I'm saying all these controversial things and some people are booing me. Why are you supporting it? I said, even these other people might even say something like I'm saying. I said, why are you supporting me? And they say, we believe you're telling the truth, or at least making the attempt, you know, to give them the facts.
Well, Ron Paul, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with the work you're doing in the Liberty Report?
Oh, just ronpaullibertyreport.com, and it's 11 Central Time. We live stream, and it usually goes for about, on average, around 30 minutes. Daniel McAdams is a co-host, and he worked with me in Washington. I consider a real expert on details of some of the foreign policy activity, you know, who did what. And he's had some experience in the State Department living overseas. So he had experience. Interestingly enough, I hope he doesn't get mad at me for saying this, but he went to Berkeley. And somebody said, what's he doing working? Well, Berkeley gave me a nice reception. But I didn't know Daniel back then.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversations with Karen Kwiatkowski and Ron Paul.
As always, if you appreciate the work I'm doing, please, 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 please consider supporting me at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. You can make monthly donations at the $1, $5, $10, or $15 tiers. Any amount will help. And at the $10 and $15 tiers, you get a producer's credit shout out. So that leads to our producer's credit shout outs for this edition of the program. Shout outs to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Ed, Gratz, James, Jamie, Mickey, Brian, The War Nerd, Amelia, Chase, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Martin, Brian S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.